Hello, everyone, and welcome to Minute 92 of Season 4 of Movie Around Minute, the daily podcast, where we take a hilarious and poignant journey through the 1989 Billy Crystal Meg Ryan rom-com, When Harry Met Sally, 1 minute at a time. I'm Rob, and joining me once again today is the Movies by Minute chronicler, Eric Nash. Welcome back to the show, Eric.
Yeah, glad to be back.
I'm glad that you were able to come back, even after we discovered what Lucky Mustard means yesterday. Yeah. So, Minute 92 begins with Harry continuing with his hypothesis and ends with Harry explaining about the sauce. So, yesterday we ended things with Harry and Sally finally making up, I guess you can say. You know, Harry gives a convincing enough speech to Sally to explain to her that she really should be loving or hating him, depending on how you want to look at it. And, you know, after they finish their embrace and kiss, so they're listening to the music. You know, we talked yesterday about the Auld Lang Syne. And Harry then tries to figure out what is Auld Lang Syne? You know, like, what are you supposed to do with it? And he basically started by saying, should old acquaintances be forgotten? Does that mean we should forget old acquaintances? Or does it mean if we happen to forget them, we should remember them? And that's where yesterday's episode ended. And today we continue with his hypothesis where he says, which is not possible because we've already forgotten them. Well, maybe. And then Sally throws in her two bits and says, well, maybe it just means that we should remember that we forgot them or something. Anyway, it's about old friends. So, you know, I like the fact that they basically are pretty much ending the love story of this movie with this little bit between the two of them, you know, because it shows a lot about their compatibility. Mm-hmm. You know, that he's making this very, very strange query about a song that they're listening to, and for her to be able to respond as opposed to say, you're an idiot, you know, that would have shown something else. But she's going with him.
Yeah.
You know, because throughout the entire movie, or many times when they've had these type of conversations, they have differing opinions on them, which makes it more interesting to obviously listen to hear both sides of the story. You know, we can go all the way back to the beginning of the movie when they were talking about the fact that, you know, men and women can't be friends. You know, that type of thing. So I like the way that basically this is the bookend for I guess the action in the movie. I mean, later on in this minute we'll get to the final scene of the movie, but at least here it's just the last action scene, you know, where something is happening between the two of them to rekindle their relationship and stuff like that.
Yeah, he quite often throughout the movie comes up with these, you know, hypotheses or rules or observations on mostly, you know, essentially dating mainly, right? It seems like,
or yeah, finding an apartment.
Yeah, and she often yeah, right. And she often has something decent to contribute, you know, so mm-hmm. some additional thing versus like what you're saying, you know, the in the relationship, if you just have one person that says these crazy things and then the other one just, you know, virtually never, you know, just disregards them and says, oh, you're being an idiot all the right. time. That's not good.
No, not at all. I think then they would have to have had a sequel to this movie, you know, where, you know, when Harry divorced Sally, or when Sally divorced Harry, or whatever. Yeah. You know, so and that probably wouldn't be as upbeat as this one is.
No,
probably not. That would be my guess. I could be wrong, but that's what I think. And then we get a shot of Harry who's just smiling. I think he's what's going through his mind is, you know, the same type of thing of what we're talking about. I actually have found someone, you know, on my level who I want to spend the rest of my life with. You know, that type of thing. Mm-hmm. Because it looks very nice the way that they do it. And then the two of them end up kissing again. And then we have the shot is really, really good. You know, the way that they do this. Mm-hmm. Because they pan out, and as they pan out, we see all the other people, you know, who have been celebrating New Year's, you know, some of them with champagne, some of them with streamers, some of them with, you know, blowing these, what are those things called? Those horns?
Noisemaker.
Party. What are they? They're called party something. Not party favors. Party. I don't remember what they're called. Party something. Party horns? I don't think so. That doesn't make sense, does it?
No. Yeah, it makes sense.
Party horns? Party. Actually, it is called a party horn. What do you know?
There you go.
Here. A party horn, also known as a party blower, a party pipe, a party elephant, a party blowout, a noisemaker, party whistle, party honker, a ta-doo-da, a noise popper, a birthday kazoo, whizzer, a blow tickler, a tongue kazoo, or a party snake. Ah, the snakes are the ones that like.
Yeah.
You know, unravel.
Yeah,
I guess.
Our dog hates those. That's the one that she hates the most.
Your dog uses party horns?
No. When we do
okay.
It.
Okay. That's what you're saying.
Yeah.
I thought you meant your dog doesn't like, you know, when you give the dog,
yeah,
you know, a.
We found out that out this past New Year's Eve.
Aha. Okay. Oh, well, so you need to make a note for yourself. Next New Year's Eve,
No
party blower in front of the dog. Right. And, I mean, we see all this confetti falling all over the people. But I like the fact that it pans out and they're not alone here. You know, it shows that they are among – you know, this whole group of people. I mean, the conversation that we've listened to over the last few days, it seems as if they are a little bit distant from everybody else. Mm-hmm. You know, you can't tell over the last, I think, 2 minutes that they really are surrounded by everyone else. We saw her trying to leave. We saw him trying to show up. But you don't see any other people around them as being as close.
Yeah.
I mean, obviously you can see people in the background and stuff like that, but it once it pans out, then you can really tell that there are lots of people at this party, and they're, you know, Harry and Sally are this little speck in this party of people who are in love on New Year's Eve, but everyone else doesn't know that they are actually two people who just figured out that they love each other, as opposed to, you know, going to the party knowing that already or not. Who knows? But they do it really well, the way that it pans out here. You know, it's a very nice shot. You see the balloons flowing around, and then it sort of focuses a little bit on the, you know, 70s disco bowl on top, you know, which is, you know, making it's shining all around and stuff like that. And that's pretty much the end of the I guess you could say, the real part of the movie. And now... they're trying to explain to us the whole point of the movie.
Yeah.
Which we'll get into a second as to whether, you know, we think that they really do or not, because we see then Harry and Sally sitting on this couch like these other documentary couples that we've been watching too. I think there were 6 or 7, if I remember correctly, throughout the entire movie. And now we see them. Now, my biggest question, well, first of all, the two of them look terrible here. Sally, her hair looks atrocious. And watching Harry, you know, in a sweater with a tie, you know, wearing a button-down shirt with a tie and sweater, it just doesn't look it doesn't look genuine to me, the way that you see them here.
Yeah.
You know, I after watching the two of them over the last, 90 plus minutes. I can't imagine either one of them, even after they're married, it doesn't matter how long after they're married, but that they would dress like this now, that they would act like this. You know, it seems to sort of take us out of what we've learned about the two of them over the course of this entire movie.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and
yeah, I'd be really curious as to whether or not, I mean, it almost seems like it's fairly disconnected from a lot of the rest of the shooting of the movie. So, I mean, could it have been some months later or something, really? Or maybe even this is before they shot anything else.
It could be.
You know?
It could be. I mean, on the commentary, they don't really discuss it, which I was a little disappointed that they would discuss, you know, like the reason. But basically what they said is the whole idea was to have them as one of these couples. But then when you try and compare them to all these couples, you know, they didn't give us any other young couples. All of the other couples were people that were married or that were, you know, let's say 50 or even 60 plus. And here you have this young couple who are in their 30s, you know, where they're trying. So like for me, their story obviously fits in with all the other crazy stories that they're telling. But I still feel some sort of disconnect here, because you would expect at least one of the couples, you know, telling their stories would have been closer in age to them or something like that. Because here it's, you know, up until now, the documentary feel of the whole thing is that, okay, let's talk to couples who have been together for X number of years and let's hear their story. The crazy coincidences or the crazy aspects of them getting together, you know, and things like that. Which, unfortunately, throughout the entire movie, I've only been able to find the truth about two of them. You know, that they're apparently all of these stories, except for Harry and Sally's, are based on real people and real people's introductions. The first one was Sol Horn and his wife, who's the father, who's basically the parents of one of the producers of the movie. And then that was the very first story that they told. You know, where the guy said that he told his friend Arthur Kornblum, you know, that's the girl I'm going to marry. Mm-hmm. And then the second story that we know is true is that we know who is the person who it's based on is the one with the summer camp. That's apparently how Nora Ephron's parents met. Okay, but all the other ones, again, the four or five other ones that we see throughout the movie, I wasn't able to gather any information from anywhere explaining whose stories those were. Because that, to me, that would have been really fascinating to know, okay, this is Rob Reiner's parents, and this one is Alan Horn's parents, and this is, you know, Nora Ephron's parents, and this is the cousin of someone, who knows? But they unfortunately don't let us in on that information. So we'll have to do it just knowing two of them, which is more than I knew before I started doing this movie. So, you know, it's not as if I haven't gained, and all of you listening haven't gained the knowledge of that information. You know, and the only other information that they really give out throughout the commentary is that in one of them, the one with the doctor and the nurse, the actor who plays the doctor is or was Rob Reiner's father, Carl Reiner's best friend, who was also his best man at his wedding. And they just decided to use him as the actor. You know, that's as close as you get to knowing what that real story was or anything like that.
Yeah, I almost feel like, you know, knowing, you know, I think I probably kind of came across it sometime before you started the show, but definitely reminded of it in listening to the show so far, is that, you know, with these being actors, you know, previously, and well, and this too, you know, but I almost feel like it would have been interesting that if they had had, it would have been a little bit of a downer though, I guess, because they didn't really, did I forget if you said this, did Rob Reiner and Nora Ephron, did they actually date, or were they were never married, right?
No, not to each other.
But yeah.
No.
But you know, it would have been interesting, you know, if instead of having actors on the screen and discussing something that's fictional, you know, if it could have been Rob and Nora sitting there and explaining, say, hey, I mean, we kind of essentially, you know, we you know, hardly any fictional thing is actually truly totally fictional. So there's always some kind of truth that any story is coming from. And they could have explained that and said these were things that, you know, we came up with that were from our dating lives, our you know, not necessarily with each other, but with all the various relationships that each of them had had.
Correct. Which, and they did. I mean, that, you know, most of this movie is based on. I mean, if you listen to the commentary, so you'll hear that someone will say, "Oh, this is based on my story. This I really did. This really happened to me." You know, things like that. So we know that the stories are coming from real people. Now, with regard to the documentary couples, so as I said, all of the stories are real except for Harry and Sally, and they actually tried at the beginning to have the real people tell the stories. And apparently it just was atrocious because they didn't have the right timing and things like that because they weren't actors. So they decided at the end they'll take the real story and then just use it as, you know, they'll just have actors play the real people. So what can you do? This is what we got. And it works well, except for the fact that again, it bothers me that the two of them basically stand out here. Among all of these documentary couples, you know, the Harry and Sally are the ones who don't fit in.
Yeah.
At least.
Well, I mean, I feel like they don't portray each other as, you know, to us, the audience, that the two of them are in love at this point.
Right. That's true also.
Yeah.
But again, also. The relationship
seems a little bit off.
Right. Because also all the other couples are telling how they met. Harry and Sally, again, we've now had 90 something minutes telling us how they met. Okay, so maybe theoretically they're sitting on the couch telling that story, you know, and then the way that it ends here is by you hear Harry saying, well, the first time we met, we hated each other. And then Sally interrupts him and says, no, you didn't hate me. I hated you. Because that's obviously, you know, he wanted to sleep with her at that point when they were on their way to from Chicago to New York. And then she says, the second time we met, you didn't even remember me. And then Harry responds, I did too. I remembered you. That was when they were in the airport where they, you know, as soon as they saw you, well, she recognized him right away. And he recognized her, but couldn't place who she was. You know, that was it. And then he says, the third time we met, we became friends. And then Sally says, we were friends for a long time. And then we weren't. And then we fell in love. And then Sally goes, 3 months later, we got married. And Harry goes, it only took 3 months. And then Sally corrects him and says, 12 years and 3 months. We had a really wonderful wedding. It was it really was a beautiful wedding. We had this enormous coconut cake, a huge coconut cake with the tears. And I love how she's like using her hands to describe the whole thing. She says this with the tears, and there was this very rich chocolate sauce on the side. And then Harry interrupts and says, right, because not everyone likes it on the cake, because it makes it very, and that's where this minute will end. But again, I like that they're telling us this, but it just doesn't fit in with all the other documentary couples, the way they're telling this story. So, I don't know. It's a good bookend for the movie. It really is. But I'm somewhat disappointed that they didn't make it fit in better. You know, that you would look at it and say, okay, you know, I can understand how this can work and stuff like that.
Yeah, I mean, it's a very quick summation of the movie between the two of them.
Right.
And, you know, but it is nice. It is the back and forth that, you know, really typifies their, you know, really speaks to their relationship that, you know, generally Harry will say something that's kind of not really all that accurate. And she gets in there and gets it precise.
Right. That's true. I mean, it's interesting the way that they, you know, that they do have a good dynamic here because they're interrupting and correcting each other, but they're doing it in a nice way. You know, I think that's what it comes down to. So, you know, she mentions that they have a coconut cake. All right. So, Eric, what do you know about coconuts?
Well, I mean, actually, in relation to cake, I mean, that's my favorite cake is German chocolate.
Ooh.
Which in the topping icing is some coconut is mixed in with whatever else it is, caramel-ish kind of. So otherwise, other than that, coconuts, I don't feel like I have too much experience. I feel like I've kind of opened one or two up once or twice in my life, but yeah, otherwise, yeah, I definitely look forward to hearing your take on coconuts.
Well, up until doing this research, the most I knew about coconuts was Gilligan's Island and Castaway.
Yeah, you know, sure.
Didn't know very much about that beyond that. Okay. So, the coconut tree is a member of the palm tree family, and it is part of the species known as coccus. COCOS. The term coconut can refer to just the whole tree, or it could refer to the seed or even the fruit. The name originally comes from the Portuguese word coco, which means head or skull, which I wonder if the Disney movie Coco is any relation to that, because the idea of, you know, the dead and a skull or something like that.
Actually, my fiance and I probably will be watching it later tonight. I haven't seen it yet.
Okay. So I won't give it away.
Oh, no. Yeah.
So the coconut tree is able to provide food, fuel, cosmetics, different types of medicines, building materials, things like that. And there are certain societies that have cultural and religious significance from to them. There are different ceremonies and different religious or cultures living in the South Pacific that use coconuts in those rituals. And as I mentioned, it's been popularized on movies and TV by Gilligan's Island and movies like Castaway, you know, where people get stuck on desert islands, stuff like that. There are two different colors that you can see of coconuts. Some of them are brown, and some of them are greenish, depending on you know, where they are, where they grow. Coconut oil is used a lot in the food industry, but it also coconut is something that can be a food allergy. Could also be anaphylactic. Therefore, you know, there are people who can theoretically die from eating parts of coconuts. You know, that their windpipe will swell up or anything like that, or something like that. So in the U.S., the FDA actually has declared the coconut that whenever you have coconut in anything, when it's an ingredient in the package has to label that it's saying of tree nut with potential allergies. So that I found that to be very interesting. But the most interesting thing I found about the coconuts is the idea that there are lots of people who've been killed by coconuts. So, basically,
what do coconuts have out for certain people, or for anyone?
I don't know. You could there, but there. Based on what I just said, there are different ways that people can actually die from a coconut. You can have a coconut falling from a tree and striking you in the head.
Yeah.
All right. It could strike people in the back, neck, shoulders, head, and it can sometimes be fatal, obviously. There is actually and then there are also people that can die because of the allergies to coconuts, right? And there are people who can also get sudden cardiac death as a result of hyperkalemia. Which is when if you drink too much coconut water, because it has a lot of potassium in it, and therefore that can cause trouble. Now there's a urban legend about the number of people that a coconut kills number of people that can die by coconut during a given year. There was a study in 1984 called "Injuries Due to Falling Coconuts," and it basically said that there are more people killed by coconuts than sharks. The claim was that there are 150 people killed every year by coconuts. How many people do you think die of shark deaths a year?
Ooh.
I mean, friend of the show, Jay Cluett, knows the answer to this. He's a big shark fan, you know, so he's probably screaming at us saying, what? No.
27?
5. Wow. That's the average. Again, there are different years where you can get different number of people who've been killed. I wonder if there are any people who've been like hit in the head with a coconut and then fallen into the water and got eaten by a shark. That would be really interesting. That would be
which one do you assign that?
That's right.
Do you assign that to?
Well, that one actually you'd say the shark, because the shark is the one who actually kills you. You know, the coconut might disorient you. Apparently, there is a claim that a falling coconut can strike a person with about 2,000 pounds of force. Which that's just amazing. There are in 2002 there were places in Queensland, Australia, that they actually began to remove coconut trees from beaches because they were afraid that people would get hit in the head with them when they were vacationing there. There was an op-ed written in the Boston Herald about travelers should watch out for coconuts, the killer fruit. Advising people not to pitch their tents under coconut trees. I don't know. This is pretty interesting, the whole thing here. But here it says that you're 30 times more likely to be killed by a falling coconut than by a shark. Yeah, and I mean, obviously you don't want to get hit by either. That's for sure. So there's also like a whole list here that I found of incidents where people were actually killed by falling coconuts. I'm obviously not going to read them all because there's a lot here, but. But there's some interesting ones here. In January 1943, a U.S. Marine was killed in his sleep when he was struck in the head by a falling coconut while he was in Guadalcanal, you know, during the World War II battle. In 1966, a resident of Papua New Guinea was killed while she was eating lunch under a coconut tree when she was struck in the head by a falling coconut. What else do we got here? Here in 1991, a mourner was killed by a falling coconut while at a funeral in Sri Lanka. That's pretty interesting that happened. I mean, it's pretty sad, but you know, for something like that to happen while you're at a funeral, I don't know. And here the final one that I'll give is in 2001 in Malaysia, a 59-year-old man was killed when a monkey that they were using to harvest coconuts, dropped a coconut on his head. So it means you need to be a little bit more weary of coconut, of who you trust to pick the coconuts. Yeah, I don't know. Oh, here's another one about someone who died by being hit in the head by a coconut during an earthquake. That was in the Philippines. So, you have anything else you want to say about this minute before we get into the script?
I don't think so.
Okay. All right. So, once again, the script is almost exactly word for word. You know, and then we have you know, the first time we hated each other, and then she corrects him, and then she says about that he didn't remember me, and then he tries to correct her. And then, you know, we became friends and we were friends for a long time and then we weren't and then we fell in love. And that all is the exact same thing there. Then it has Harry says 2 months later we got married. But in the movie, I think they said it was 4 months later. And they don't talk about the tears on the cake. It basically says, it was a beautiful wedding. Yeah, we had this incredible coconut cake. And then Sally interrupts and says, with a very rich chocolate sauce on the side. And then Harry says, yeah, you know, because everybody doesn't like sauce right on top of their cake. So it's a little different. You know, I like the dynamic in the movie itself because, you know, we see the two of them interacting. You know, they're even with just their hands and stuff like that, they're able to show a lot of what's going on and stuff like that. It's more active this way, I guess you can say. So I like the way they do that. Every Tuesday we have a segment called Off the Beaten Track, a dating courting edition, where my guest will give some sort of story, anecdote, adventure, misadventure, something that's happened to them over the course of their life that is related to either dating or courting. So Eric, you have a story for us?
Yeah, I mean, essentially kind of with me and my fiance, we met by starting at work, you know, as a retail job, within a week of each other. We just had this weird happenstance that happened. And, you know, it was retail. I just kind of like decided to step away from like a quote unquote better job career kind of thing that I was in. I'm now back in. But and she was just following her daughter from one store to another. Kind of thing is how she got there, but just really weirdly, just at the same time, and it's just like essentially we just like slowly became friends over the course of about 9 months or so, And she more so than I realized that we had some romantic chemistry, you know, and she kind of hit me over the head, brought me home, so to speak. It's definitely a joke between us. And you know, and the thing is that like we kind of kept our relationship secret for a while there at this store because she was kind of my supervisor. She had become over that period of time, but eventually like our district manager found out, and I ended up going to another nearby store that I didn't quite realize we didn't realize you know was a possibility that I could go to.
Oh, wow.
Which is why we're keeping it secret. We wouldn't have kept it secret if we said, oh yeah, I could one of us could just go to this other store that's close by versus one that's further away.
Oh, wow.
But you know, it's essentially just you know, this little how we met kind of story that I thought I'd get across here, and I'll definitely have a little bit of a continuation of that for the one later in the week.
All right. Excellent. Thank you very much. So, yeah. Eric, you want to tell people how they can find you, where they can find Eric Nash?
Yeah. So I'll mention the second Movies by Minute show that I've done, or actually I'm in the middle of at this time. It's on a little bit of a hiatus, but definitely suggest everyone go check it out. It's Almost Famous Minute, where I covered essentially on my own, but every now and then I kind of consider some guests that I had as my co-hosts. I was kind of the one doing all the legwork, but so for the 2000 movie Almost Famous by Cameron Crowe, kind of his somewhat autobiographical movie that he did, and that's on the unlike the other the first show I mentioned yesterday, that and my other show, the two more recent shows are on the Pantheon podcast network. So you definitely you can just go directly there to check them out or just find them in your various podcatchers that you might be.
Cool. Thank you very much for that. And finding me is very simple. Just do a quick search for Movie Around Minute. You can find me on my website, moviearoundminute.com. You can find me on Twitter and you can find me on Facebook. So until tomorrow, I'll have what she's having.
I'll have what she's having.
Gave me a thrill. With all your faults, I love you still. It had to be you. Wonderful you. Had to be you.